ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion begins in Sydney with a clear mandate and a tight deadline. But as the Jewish community reckons with the atrocities of Bondi, will expectations meet reality? Former Federal Court Judge Ronald Sackville joins us shortly. Also ahead, movie award ceremonies are famous for protest speeches and competing egos. But a special kind of controversy has erupted at the British Academy Film Awards after a member of the BAFTA audience shouted racial slurs at black actors on stage. The outburst has been blamed on Tourette syndrome, sparking a fierce debate about the disability and how we should apologise for it or not. And for years, the body positive movement fought the good fight against fat shaming until, that is, a miracle jab arrived.
Oh!
People with type 2 diabetes are excited about the potential of once-weekly Ozempic.
Ozempic, it was invented to treat people with type 2 diabetes, but it's morphed into a weight loss free-for-all. A new book by journalist Amy Donnellan called Off the Scales explores this dramatic and lucrative medical, scientific and social revolution. But first up tonight, the Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion Royal Commission opened today with a warning that it will not be able to hear direct evidence about the Bondi terrorist attack because of the risk of prejudicing the case against the alleged gunman when it goes to trial. That means no witnesses giving evidence to the criminal hearing will front the Royal Commission. What that means for the families involved is still unclear, but it will limit their capacity to provide personal testimony from the day. This is the first Royal Commission in nearly 50 years to investigate our intelligence agencies, a process that will undoubtedly be complex and at times will cause tensions. And with an interim report due by the end of April and a final report due by mid-December, the pressure on the Royal Commission is intense, as the Commissioner Virginia Bell acknowledged today in her opening remarks.
I acknowledge that for some, it will never be right to speak of closure. But one small part of coming to terms with the events of that evening will be the work of this Commission. I regard the delivery of my report on or before the first anniversary as a matter of critical importance.
But despite Commissioner Bell's determination to meet the deadline, one former judge calls this timeframe fanciful. Ronald Sackville, KC, was chair of the Disability Royal Commission, which ran from 2019 to 2023. He's also a former federal court judge. Ronald Sackville, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you very much, Fran. It's good to talk to you again.
Ron, you were one of many pushing for this Royal Commission. How critical is it for this country, for this inquiry to get underway and to actually just happen?
Yes, I think it's very important. It's obviously extremely important for the Jewish community, which has been, I should say, traumatised not just by the events of 14 December, but by a lot of what has occurred since October 7, since the attacks in Israel and the consequences in Gaza. So it's been a time of great anxiety, of fear, difficulty of the Jewish community. That's important. But I think it's also important for the wider community because some of the issues that are going to be explored are not necessarily confined to the Jewish community, but they deal with questions of tolerance, understanding, ability to deal with different ideologies, all of which come together in the form of an inquiry into anti-Semitism.
And I'll come to that in a minute. I want to go to some of the question marks you had before the Commissioner spoke today, the timeframe. I think everyone agrees it's very tight. In your view, as someone who's run a Royal Commission, is it enough time for this Royal Commission to investigate the complex issues in front of it?
Yeah. I don't think I've ever said that the time frame is fanciful, but
someone then said it. I'm sorry if I misquoted you. I beg your pardon.
Oh, that's all right. I'm normally a little more careful than that. Look, I think that there is a significant problem, and the problem was revealed in Commissioner Bell's comments today. I think she was very realistic. She said, as you've played, that it is of critical importance to adhere to the deadline, but she also said that she accepts that there will be limits imposed on what the Royal Commission can do because of that constraint. And one of my concerns is that the Royal Commission is not going to be able to investigate some matters of considerable significance that are within the terms of reference because the time limit is so stringent. And there are also other consequences, one of which is that apparently there are not going to be any private sessions in this Royal Commission for people who wish to tell their story to a commissioner or to an assistant commissioner, as the Act provides. And I think that is a pity because it's going to inhibit some people from being prepared to share their stories of anti-Semitism with the Royal Commission, and it's going to deprive the Royal Commission of some information that otherwise it would receive.
Though Commissioner Bell did invite people to give submissions and urge them that didn't mean they had to give public testimony, so she's asking people to submit anyway.
She is, but there's a vast difference between making a written submission and having a private session with a commissioner or someone in authority where you are offered support before, during and after the private session, and you're able to tell their story to someone in person and to know that that story will be recorded and can be reproduced in anonymised form in the final report, which is, of course, what happened with the Disability Royal Commission, where we had something like 1,800 private sessions. Mm. There are many people, Fran, who are not going to be prepared to put their stories in written submissions, but they may feel uncomfortable doing that. They may feel that there is a risk of being re-traumatised by the process, and many of them may simply not understand what is required to put their experiences into written form. So I think it's not quite right to say that just inviting written submissions serves the same purpose as private sessions.
Can I go to a couple of the other limitations that the Commissioner outlined today? Commissioner Bell indicated she's not interested in hearing from every aggrieved party on the issue of social cohesion. Here she is.
I expect that social cohesion will be advanced by measures that address discrimination against religious faiths, ethnicities and cultures generally.
Now,
nonetheless, against the background of the massacre of innocent people who appear to have been targeted simply because they were Jewish, I trust everyone will appreciate why the focus of this commission will be on tackling anti-Semitism as a starting point in strengthening our bonds of social cohesion.
Ron, do you agree? Do you think everyone will appreciate that the focus is on tackling anti-Semitism, given this Royal Commission is called a Royal Commission to Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion?
Now, of course, not everybody will agree, but as it happens, if I may say so, I think Commissioner Bell is right. When you read the terms of reference, they are clearly directed to investigating anti-Semitism, and the concept of social cohesion within the terms of reference has to be understood by reference to that social problem, that problem of great importance, so that I think she, if I may say so, that Commissioner Bell's right to take that view, but in any event, there's really no option. It's difficult enough within a period of 11 months to contemplate exploring the matters that are expressly dealt with in the terms of reference, let alone getting into all the other areas of hate conduct or speech directed at other groups, whether religious, ethnic or otherwise.
But does that mean that the groups like Muslim groups who have, you know, also recounted a rise in Islamophobic attacks since, well, since certainly the war on Gaza began, but also even since Bondi, and Indigenous Australians who have also said, you know, and have recently had attacks on them, that they won't be able to offer anything to this, they won't be heard by this Royal Commission?
Well, I don't know whether they'll be heard. I think it's open to anyone to make a submission, and the Commission, I suspect, will receive any submissions that are made. But I think that Commissioner Bell, in her opening remarks, has made it pretty clear what the focus of this Royal Commission will be. And, of course, it was set up in response to the atrocious events of Bondi and as a result, primarily, of the pressure exerted by the Australian Jewish community. Not all parts of the Australian Jewish community, but by far the greater proportion. It would simply be, and as she said, it would simply be unmanageable to undertake an investigation of all forms of race hatred that Australia has experienced.
Yeah, whether,
whether there's justification for another Royal Commission on another issue, well, that's a separate question.
Ronald Sackville-KC is my guest. He's a former federal court judge and former chair of, he was the chair of the Disability Royal Commission. The other limitation that the Commission spelled out today is, in terms of a time frame, is that she won't enter into a debate around the definition of anti-Semitism. She intends to use the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, quote, a certain perception of Jews that may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. As a Jewish person, are you satisfied with this definition and her acceptance of it? Because not everybody is.
Of course they're not. I am satisfied, and I've written about it recently as to why I'm satisfied. I think the critics, including people like Ben Saul, for example, who said that a couple of the examples that are attached to the definition prevent, for example, legitimate criticism of Israel, I think he's wrong. And I think that Commissioner Bell is quite right to say that when you look at the language of the definition and the context in which any acts that are alleged to be anti-Semitic need to be considered, the definition is perfectly workable. It doesn't do what a lot of the critics claim it does, and a lot of them simply misread the actual language. There is, in fact, a recent decision in Britain applying the definition or the examples within the definition and doing that in a way that is extremely sensible and allows for legitimate criticism, even strident, even uninformed criticism of Israel that is not to be regarded as anti-Semitic, but the core of the definition is hatred expressed in relation to Jews, and that means, in this context, Australian Jews.
And Ron Sackville, the Royal Commissioner also made it clear today that the Royal Commission cannot and must not run foul of any the ongoing criminal case against the alleged gunman. He faces 15 murder charges, 40 attempted murder charges. How does this complicate the Commissioner's job and her capacity to deliver not just meaningful recommendations, but to also deliver on people's expectations?
Yeah, well, I think that's an important issue. The qualification in the terms of reference is perfectly standard. It's a standard form of protection of criminal proceedings that the Royal Commissions are not intended to prejudice actual or contemplated criminal proceedings.
And everyone will agree with that, but what does it mean in practice? Because I suspect, again, it's going to disappoint a lot of people, and the Commissioner is making a special trip to speak with some of the families of the victims of the Bondi massacre.
Yeah. My understanding is she already has spoken to them and will speak to them again to explain this limitation, and I think that's a very sensible and appropriate thing to do. I don't think this is going to make a huge difference to the way the Royal Commission operates. I personally would not necessarily see hearing from some of the victims of their own experiences, what's happened to them after the event, as necessarily impinging on any criminal criminal proceedings, but obviously the Royal Commissioner has to make her own judgment about that. And that's another area, by the way, where private sessions might come into it, because there could be private sessions that allow people to talk about their experiences without any risk of criminal proceedings being prejudiced.
Ron, the other element that was mentioned today and is going to be writ large in this Royal Commission is the investigation of the security and intelligence services and, you know, the events leading up to this and their practices leading up to us and if there's been any issues there. We've already heard that the intelligence agencies are seeking legal advice. Former intelligence chief Dennis Richardson, former head of ASIO, is on hand to assist the commissioner. What do you think is going to work here? Will the Royal Commissioner, does she have the powers to compel the federal police or the local police or the security agencies to give evidence?
The short answer is yes, she does, subject to certain qualifications. There may be immunity, public interest immunity in certain respects if there are matters of national security, and they may require hearings, if they are to be held in private. The unusual feature of this Royal Commission is that an existing inquiry is somehow folded into the Royal Commission, and Mr. Richardson has not had powers of compulsion, unlike Commissioner Bell, so that Mr. Richardson's report, which is supposed to be delivered, or the Royal Commission's interim report is supposed to be delivered by April, it's a bit difficult to see that any form of public hearing or exercise of powers of compulsion against officers of ASIO or the police and so forth could really take place in a meaningful way before that interim report is due. So it's a rather odd situation. It would certainly be open to the Commissioner, even after the presentation of the interim report, to conduct hearings, whether in public or private, and to exercise powers of compulsion. But whether she's got the time to do that and whether she thinks that it is appropriate having regard to the interim report are other questions.
And Ron Sackville, just finally, one of the reasons the Prime Minister resisted a Royal Commission was, as he said, that it could harm social cohesion. What does this Royal Commission need to do to avoid the risk of platforming anti-Semitic views or ignoring the, you know, rightly held views of some other communities?
I don't think you ignore the rightly held views of other communities. You make the point that this is an inquiry specifically into anti-Semitism and the consequences that it has produced. Social cohesion is defined in the terms of reference in a way that is at such a level of generality that it's not helpful. An exploration of what social cohesion really means, which involves questions of respect, of interaction between different groups in the community, trying to address ideological differences mm-hmm. with respect. That's the sort of thing that the Royal Commission, I think, can advance by reference to what's happened with anti-Semitism and dealing with anti-Semitism. But the lessons that can be learned from that are equally applicable to other forms of combat or other ways of combating other forms of race hatred. Yeah. So I think there are things that can be done. They're not necessarily in the form of legislation or more prohibitions. The criminal law is a very blunt instrument, as we know, but there are all sorts of models that can be used to increase the community's ability to deal with differences in a constructive, tolerant and understanding way. I think we need much more of that.
As the Commissioner said, it's a start. Ron Sackville, thank you very much for joining us, and perhaps we can catch up with you as the Royal Commission rolls on.
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Ronald Sackville KC, former chair of the Disability Royal Commission and a former federal court judge. And coming up, Ozempic. It was invented to treat people with type 2 diabetes. It's morphed into a weight loss free-for-all. Journalist Amy Donnellan joins me to talk about her new book exploring this dramatic and lucrative medical and social revolution.
On Breakfast Tomorrow with Sally Sara.
US President Donald Trump says any country that plays games on trade will face higher tariffs. You'll hear from a shipping and trade expert about what the president is doing after the US Supreme Court struck down many of his Liberation Day tariffs. And on Changing Australia, you'll hear from a leading voice in the fight to stop forced marriages.
Radio National Breakfast, weekday mornings from 5:30 or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
The Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly.
It's a night to celebrate the world's finest films of 2025, but the British Film Awards, or BAFTAs as they're known, have been overshadowed by controversy. And it's nothing to do with the movies themselves. It was a racial slur, the N-word, which was yelled out from the audience as two black actors, Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo, took to the stage to present the first award of the night.
Good evening. Delroy and I are delighted to be presenting the first BAFTA of the night for a vital part of movie making.
We're here to celebrate the artists who expand what's possible on screen.
Effects can create spectacle, but the best work serves character and story.
As you can hear, we beeped the slur there. It was uttered involuntarily by John Davidson. John's lived most of his life with Tourette syndrome and campaigned in schools and the justice system for a better understanding and tolerance of the disability. And he was the inspiration for the biopic I Swear, which took home the award for leading actor. BAFTA's host, Alan Cumming, twice interrupted the ceremony to appeal for the audience's understanding and apologising for any offence. But that didn't stop actors like Jamie Foxx furiously tweeting about the incident, claiming in a post that John Davidson had meant what he said and that it was, quote, unacceptable. Connor Macy was diagnosed with this specific type of Tourette's called coprolalia at the age of 21, and he's now a National Education Advisor with the Tourette Syndrome Association of Australia. Connor, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I'm also joined by Professor Valsama Eapen, the Chair of Infant, Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at UNSW, specialising in Tourette syndrome and autism. Valsama, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Connor, let's start with you. I don't know if you were awake in the middle of the night watching the BAFTAs, but I'm sure you've heard about this incident. What went through your mind, Connor, when you heard what had happened?
Yeah, no, I wasn't awake. Actually, I was fast asleep. I woke up to everything all over the media today. My first thought really was just how much this is an exactly how we all live our lives every day as people with Tourette's. You know, we're always worried about going to places like this and causing a scene. And now here it is happening in front of everybody.
So you can strongly identify with John Davidson's experience at that moment.
Oh, 100%. You know, I always have to, every time I want to go somewhere, I always have to weigh up how much I want to go there versus how much of a problem my Tourette's might cause me by going there. You know, if I want to go support a family member at a school event, if I want to go out to a movie with my girlfriend, you know, all these things have to be weighed up. And it's kind of my every single day today for people with Tourette's.
So gather from what you're saying that something like this has happened to you, Connor.
Yeah, many times, many, many times where I've said something inappropriate, it's been taken the wrong way, or it just hasn't been explained to the people around me what's going on. And you can get into some altercations. I've been stopped by the police multiple times, you know, to make sure that I'm okay and that I'm not under the influence of something. I've gone into arguments with mums in shopping centres about how my language is inappropriate around their children. And I've gotten into conversations with people on the street about race and disability and things like that as well. I almost always feel like I'm having to explain and apologise for my existence.
That must be really hard.
It is. It is extremely hard. Which is one of the reasons this movie is so amazing. I actually read John's book and it really changed my life. Just knowing how much somebody else could understand what I go through on a day-to-day and to just see that reflected in his work and his understanding really, really changed how I feel about myself.
Well, sir, for someone who has Tourette's, can you help us understand what's actually going on in their brains that make them blurt out these kind of slurs or abuse?
One of the things that we do, whether we are moving or whether we are saying something, there's a lot of back and forth between, for example, the muscles that would be used for moving versus the back and forth of the brain. Should I move? How much should I move? Would I hit someone? That is kind of happening without us even realizing. It's very, very kind of quick and happens. But if you have a situation where it's being released without those checks and it's just coming out. And it's the same for the words or whatever you yell out or shout out or the movements that you make. Usually we have got a sensory motor gating mechanism by which the urges neurophysiologically that happens in the brain is kept behind that gate. So when you've got a little bit of a leaky gate, those urges, which we call the premonitory sensation or the kind of real urge to do it, mm-hmm. creeps out into the conscious awareness. And once you get that urge, you kind of do it. And then before you know it, it's all happened.
And is there anything someone can do, and I'll ask you this too, Connor, but anything someone can do, Valsa, to strengthen the gate, close the gate, or train themselves somehow to control that?
Yeah, that's what usually happens with brain when it matures. Some of that inhibitory brake systems become a little bit more active, and because we also learn other strategies to do those things, and that's why it takes get better, as we say, in good number. And when you have got behavioral methods of treatment where you are trained to catch that urge, and then physically you contract the opposing muscle. So if you have got a urge to move your jaw forward, you will catch that urge and then contract the muscles of the neck so that you literally prevent yourself from doing it. And that's breaking that urge tick relief cycle and strengthening, if you like, that inhibitory circuitry. The urge is there, but you still don't need to complete it. And then again, we've got medication, because many of the neuronal circuitry that kind of determines and regulates and governs all these movements and vocalizations are run by chemicals. And so the neurotransmitters like dopamine is important for the movements. So we can use medication as well to kind of help.
Connor, have your tics got better? Do you employ strategies or medication to control it, and has it worked for you?
I agree with what Vas is saying there, with just like one kind of slight stipulation in that, like, although they can kind of, you know, be controlled and learn to kind of manage them, it is also something that's very difficult to do, especially in a moment-to-moment basis based on, you know, stress and things like that as well. Which is why I can imagine it would be very hard for someone to do that in a peak moment, much like John is in at the BAFTAs. But yeah, I think I always talked when I talk to people, I explain that the way I manage my Tourette's is mostly through lifestyle and kind of management of my own life, making sure I'm eating right, making sure I'm getting enough sleep, making sure that I'm doing what I can to avoid situations which are going to cause me anxiety and stress, or may lead me to, you know, have more tics and have more need to, you know, try to control them.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests are Professor Valsema Eapen from UNSW. She's the Chair of Infant, Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, specialising in Tourette syndrome, and Tourette's educator, Connor Macy. And we're talking about the controversy that's erupted around the BAFTAs, where, remember, the audience with Tourette's uttered a racial slur during the event. BAFTAs host Alan Cunningham twice apologised to the audience during the event for the slurs, explaining how they happened.
You may have heard some strong and offensive language tonight. Tourette syndrome is a disability, and the tics you've heard tonight are involuntary, which means the person who has Tourette syndrome has no control over their language. We apologise if you were offended.
And John Davidson, the person who uttered the phrases, said afterwards he was, quote, deeply mortified if anyone considers my involuntary tics to be intentional or to carry any meaning. But some people don't seem to have accepted that apology. Actor Jamie Foxx, as I mentioned, posted on Instagram, nah, he meant that, unacceptable. Connor, you've been in this situation. When you see that from an actor like Jamie Foxx or others, how does it feel?
It feels like a lack of understanding, you know, and almost a, you know, they deliberately don't want to understand. You know, I understand that, you know, Jamie Foxx isn't a Tourette's advocate. He's not a disability advocate. He's probably a black rights advocate. And so for him, he needs to push his side of it, you know. But to kind of to completely disregard everything that's being said to you about a disability, to kind of forward your beliefs, I think, is uncomfortable.
For the BAFTAs host, Alan Cunningham, to come out twice during the night as he did to give that explanation, do you think that's a step forward?
Definitely. You know, it is my belief that we find acceptance through understanding. You know, when people understand Tourette's and why we do what we do and what it is that we're doing, I think it's a lot easier for people to find that acceptance within themselves.
And Connor, what does it feel like? I wonder if you can explain for us what it feels like when you can feel a word coming up out of you. Are you conscious of that? Can you feel it, even if you can't stop it?
So usually before anything, I will get something called a premonitory urge, mm-hmm. Which is something I kind of describe as like a feeling of dread, or just this kind of internal feeling that something is uncomfortable or something is wrong. And that's usually the first sign that I'm going to like have some kind of tick, at least. From there, I won't know what kind of tick it is. But then usually, as Valsa described, I'll like feel like a part of my body essentially wanting to activate, whether it be like my vocal cords, for example, mm-hmm. my voice box. And then I might not know what I'm going to say. You know, it could be that I just yell out a yell. It could be that I let out a sentence of words. It could be that I let out one particular word, like John did. And I guess that's where, for me, probably a lot of it has to do with John's internal monologue. As he's worried about the things that he's going to say, he's almost creating the anxiety and the concern within himself about the things that he might say. And then he's probably going to say it. But then once you've said it, you almost get this temporary sense of relief. Like you get this like a rush of neurotransmitters that make you feel calm and relaxed mm-hmm. Briefly afterwards. However, once you kind of then take into account the situation and the scenario that you're in, often that sense of that good feeling goes away very quickly as you have to deal with the repercussions of whatever it is you said or did.
I'll bet that's really difficult sometimes, and sometimes is mortified the right word to describe what you might feel? I mean, if you'd said something like John Davidson called out?
Oh, 100%. You know, I've said some truly awful things to people I really love. You know, I'm constantly telling my girlfriend not to touch me, that she's disgusting, that I hate her. I once looked my mum dead in the eye and said, "I hope you die, bitch." You know, and I think mortified is exactly the term. You almost don't even realize what you've just said, and then it's come out of your mouth and you're processing it at the same time as the person you've said it to. And especially when, you know, it's something that you know will hurt them, even when they try to smile it off and say it's okay, that can still be really difficult to deal with, you know, but I can apologize for the damage that's been done, which is, I think, what John's tried to do.
Valsa, John Davidson made these comments when there were two black actors on stage. That's when he called out the N-word. Would I be right to think that them being on stage was the trigger for him to call out this very taboo word?
Very difficult to kind of completely understand why people say what they say in what circumstances, because the urge to relief is something that is not, the total thing is not in your control. So you can't anticipate anything, but there's a lot of environmental triggers. So it's like if you see a button saying, a red button saying, don't press, it's almost like you have to press. Or it's like an itch or a sneeze that's coming, especially if you're in church and you're very much self-conscious, you're anxious, you're stressed, the ability to control that is even less. So it's a bit like that urge to take relief completely takes over. And sometimes you're better able to manage that than at other times. And those situations, like Connor was saying, would have been one that raises your stress anxiety level to the hilt, which means your control mechanisms are very limited.
And as I said earlier, the actor Jamie Foxx said, no, he meant it, that's unacceptable. Does the uttering of these words mean that privately John Davidson holds the views he's expressing? Privately he thinks calling someone the N-word is okay?
Somebody describes it as bad thought without the bad intention. Because we, as I was saying before, there are a lot of things that go on in our minds, in our heads, when we see things. There are things that trigger people. It's not like we process it and say what's to be said or what not to be said, because we've got that all kinds of screening mechanisms and back and forth with what to do, when, where, and all that. When that's kind of not working for in your favor, you're really at the mercy of this big sneeze that has come out even before you have realized.
And Connor, for you, do you assure people that's not what I really think? This is not my subconscious blurting it out, or are they sometimes related?
No, they're almost like, you know, it's usually the one thing I don't want to say. It's like the one thing I'm trying not to say about someone, you know, especially when I, you know, when you have a history of saying things that are uncomfortable or make people feel a certain way, you then are like hyper aware of the things that you may say to make people uncomfortable. And then you almost put them in your head. But no, generally it's like, it's for me, often it'll be the way that I don't want to be perceived, is how my coprolalia comes out. So for me, it tends to be a lot of like misogyny and sexism, and like homophobia, transphobia, because those are the things that I'm like, you know, worried that people will view me as.
Mm. I'm speaking with Professor Valsema Epen. She's a psychiatrist specialising in Tourette's syndrome in young people. And Connor Macy, who's a Tourette's educator and has the disability Tourette's syndrome himself. And we're talking about the controversy that's erupted around the BAFTAs, the British Film Awards, where a member of the audience with Tourette's shouted out involuntarily a racial slur. One of the major criticisms of the what happened at the BAFTAs is the failure of the BBC to edit out the racial slur in their broadcast. The broadcast wasn't live. It went to air 2 hours later. The BBC did remove other controversial comments, some comments about Palestine, and the BBC has also apologised. But, Valsa, I'm wondering if you think that comment from John should have been edited out. Would that have improved things, taken the pressure off people who have Tourette syndrome right now today, or would it have amounted to the silencing of the experience of people with Tourette's? What do you reckon?
I would have liked it to be a bit of both, because initially itself introducing that and talking about it to raise awareness definitely could have been said right in the beginning rather than after things have happened. And so you are doing the job of not being silent, not silencing anyone, but you're absolutely providing correct awareness and increasing the knowledge.
Well, Connor, let's ask you, what did you think about the fact that the BBC didn't edit out this racial slur? It went to air when other controversial comments were edited. What do you think about that? Are you glad it went to air or not?
I like what Valsa is saying there about, you know, you can remove the pressure by censoring. Although I'm of a mind that no censorship is actually the better course of action. Simply because it is, like you say, it's like a silencing or a hiding of Tourette's, and especially of an evening where they were celebrating the movie about Tourette's. It feels kind of crazy to me that they would want to silence Tourette's in that moment, rather than showing the world what it truly is to have Tourette's. It's also my belief that by censoring these words, you're saying that they have meaning, that there was intent, that these words have to be hidden because there was like an intent to harm or an intent to hurt people with these words, whereas that's not what it is with Tourette's. And by censoring them, you're giving them that power.
Connor, I really appreciate you sharing your experience as someone with Tourette syndrome with us. You know, I've been doing this job for a very long time, and I haven't often talked to anyone with Tourette, so I think it's really illuminating. Thank you very much for joining me.
No, thank you for having me.
And Valsa, thank you too.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's Connor Macy, a National Education Advisor with the Tourette Syndrome Association of Australia, and Professor Valsema Epen, the Chair of Infant, Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at UNSW. And John Davidson is the person who caused this storm. He was the inspiration for the biopic I Swear, which took home the BAFTA for the leading actor, Robert Arameo. And I Swear will be available in Australia later next month. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. When it came time for the pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk to find a name for a new drug they're about to release, they wanted something that sounded strong and potent, something that brought to mind, you know, the Olympics.
Oh!
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 People with type 2 diabetes are excited about the potential of once-weekly Ozempic.
Ozempic. Ozempic belongs to a class of drugs called GLP-1, and it's helped millions of people around the world to overcome life-threatening type 2 diabetes by controlling their blood sugars and suppressing their appetites. And it's helped millions more shed kilos of weight, a lot of kilos. Despite all the talk of loving the body you're in, the allure of this hunger-free shred has turned GLP-1 therapies into a weight loss juggernaut, freely embraced by celebrities like Oprah Winfrey and Rebel Wilson. So, is it just a shortcut to getting skinny? And do we really understand its effect on our health? And what about the hard-fought body positive movement? So many questions. And to help us answer them, I'm joined by journalist Amy Donlan, author of Off the Scales, the inside story of Ozempic and the race to cure obesity. Amy, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks very much. Lovely to be here.
It's a scientific story, really. It's about scientific medicine. But you open with a case study of a woman named Sarah. Why did you start with Sarah's story?
Sarah is, I think, emblematic of the sort of impact these drugs can have on people's lives. So Sarah was, you know, a young woman in her 30s. She was really battling her weight, you know, all of her life. She remembers going to a dietitian when she was 7, being told to count her Cheerios, that she was, you know, always on a diet, basically. And then she gets to the end of this diet, one where she lost 30 pounds, and it all comes creeping back on. And she's in her nurse's office, and this nurse says, you know, you don't need to go on another diet. You could actually try these drugs. And it's sort of her journey then over the next year of losing about 70 pounds and all of the sort of doors that open up as a result of that. So she talks about how she got a big promotion at work, a massive pay rise. She gets engaged to her long-term boyfriend. Just her father, who was a very loving but maybe a bit absent father, is much more attentive to her. And when she told me this story, the reason I wanted to open it up is because I'm not for a second suggesting that that's what these drugs do and this is what they should do. But for many people I spoke to, this seemed to be what would happen, is that they would somehow realize the sort of lives of thin people, that what happens when you're in a bigger body, and that part is called the invisible cloak, is that she felt completely invisible. She actually thought her identity was an introvert that, you know, really struggled with shyness. But actually, as the weight comes off, and maybe she does feel a bit better, people are engaging with her. They're touching her arm when she's speaking to them. They're looking straight in her eyes, that everything is changing. And I just kind of wanted to open the book up really with that discussion about, you know, what that says about our society, is that, you know, these drugs are very necessary for people who are living with obesity, but they are also extremely attractive to people who just want to lose some weight. So that was the reason I opened with it.
In Sarah's case, this is a story about health and well-being. She has been overweight her whole life, and the nurse suggested she do this. But it also, as you say, says something about our society. So what are you trying to achieve with this book, we'll come to the science, which goes through the science but does the other as well?
I think there's a lot of taboo about these drugs still. I meet people regularly. I've even been interviewed by many people who tell me they're on these drugs and then say, please don't tell anyone I'm on these drugs.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to open up a discussion really about these drugs and talk about things that people are not talking about, which is that these drugs, as you said, were intended for people who have, you know, this disease that is impacting their life, causing all sorts of issues, but that they have become a phenomenon around the world for people who really want to lose weight and how important that is. So I really wanted to discuss that. I also did want to, as you said, shine a light on the scientific discovery element of it as well, because obviously there's a real kind of drama to that, which is that this woman was written out of the story, who was a co-inventor of the drugs. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of case studies in the book. There's a lot of boardrooms where they're discussing how these drugs are going to be used, how they're going to market the drugs. And all of that I just found myself fascinating, and just sort of like, I guess, the real inside story.
Amy Donlan is my guest, talking about her new book, Off the Scales, which delves into the story behind the pharmaceutical drug Ozempic and other of these GLP-1 medications. Let's go to the science of it. Originally, these medications, as I said, were developed as a way of dealing with type 2 diabetes. How does a drug like Ozempic or Wegovy or any of the other brand names work for diabetes?
So it's really quite amazing. So what these drugs do is that they bring down your blood sugar, which is obviously very important for type 2 diabetes, which is what they were intended to treat to begin with. And before these drugs came along, the only treatment really was insulin. And although insulin does bring down your blood sugar, it brings it down like a jackhammer. It brings it down very, very quickly, and sometimes too quickly. If the sort of cocktail of the recipe is wrong, it'll bring down your blood sugar too far, and you can go into a coma and you can have all sorts of health issues. So the scientists who were trying to find a treatment for type 2 diabetes were really trying to find something that brought that down much more gradually and brought it down to this like optimum level. And that's exactly what these drugs did. They brought your blood sugar almost like a thermostat down to just the right level and then switched off. And that was why they were so amazing, just even for type 2 diabetes.
And your book details the development of this class of drugs. There was a number of horses in that race. There was a team in America at a hospital, a team in Denmark at the pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk on this path. What different roles did they play in the final development of the GLP-1 drugs, drugs like Ozempic?
Yeah, so they were very much, both of them, as you said, the University of Copenhagen and then Mass General in Boston, they were both really just trying to almost like proof of concept, whether GLP-1 existed. They found it in fish, first of all. They didn't really know whether it existed properly in the human body. They did not know what it did in the human body. So they had to run a number of tests. There's a very fascinating scientist called Svetlana Moisov, who comes from the former Yugoslavia to Mass General. And she is a chemist. So she's literally making, synthesizing, creating these compounds, you know, like in her lab so that they can test them and see whether it does have any effect on blood sugar. And then in the University of Copenhagen, another scientist, Jens Juul Holst, was doing the same thing. So they were very much doing similar things, publishing papers around the same time. And from speaking to all of them, I think they all agree that there wasn't really an outright winner, but they were very much driving each other on, sort of like the space race with Russia and the US, that it made almost them each other better by competing the way they were.
And the development from inception to getting into the pharmacies took more than 40 years. At what point did these companies and these scientists realize the potential of this diabetes drug to help people lose weight? Lots of weight.
So there was we moved to Denmark now. So this is where Novo Nordisk, which makes Ozempic, this is where they were. And there was a number of rats in a lab. And in the book I refer to as like developed an eating disorder. So these rats were being exposed to tumors that were churning out GLP-1. And what they found was the rats were starving themselves. So they weren't eating at all once they were being exposed to kind of big quantities of these drugs consistently. So then they were thinking that they were never looking at it from weight loss. They were always looking at it from type 2 diabetes. But during that process, it became quite evident that these drugs also had weight loss properties. And the thing about type 2 diabetes is a lot of people who have type 2 diabetes also are living with obesity. Mm. So there was two scientists that were looking at it going, we could actually be a preventative company. We wouldn't have to be treating type 2 diabetes. We could actually get to the source of this first. But there was quite a lot of fight internally within that company because obesity is so stigmatized. And in Denmark, they just, there was two executives who, you know, are talking about how healthy they are, how much running they do and cycling, and that they really didn't have any role in obesity, that obesity was a lifestyle situation. It was not something that needed to be treated with pharmaceuticals. And I think one of the best sort of parts of the book is really the scientists almost ignoring those direct orders, going around their bosses, doing these little side projects to really prove these things. And then when they get all of the evidence, presenting it to their bosses and going, well, this is what the drug does. And then it was basically handed to Novo Nordisk on a platter, this enormous market.
Journalist Amy Donlan is my guest. Her new book, Off the Scales, delves into the story behind Ozempic and other GLP-1 medications. There's plenty of GPs hailing the impact of Ozempic on the obesity epidemic as life-saving, Amy. But what about its social impact in terms of attitudes to weight and body shape? In the 90s, we had fairly emaciated-looking models called heroin chic, but with the 2000s came the whole body positive movement. We saw larger-sized models, body shaming was out, and then Ozempic hits the market. Do you think the rise of these drugs like Ozempic and others have essentially killed the body positive movement?
I don't think they've killed it, but I think that they have definitely damaged it, I would say. And I think that there is now a very large focus on being thin. And I think that that is coming from Hollywood. I think that almost every award ceremony you watch, there is a joke about Ozempic. The host looks out at a crowd, of very, very thin people. And it's like, oh, is Ozempic right for me? That is the joke. And when I go out for dinner or to, you know, parties or anything, most people I talk to say, you know, have you ever taken them? Should I be on them? Should I microdose? Like, I think that there is just so many people who want to lose weight and they feel like this is an option now. This is something that they can do.
But they also feel, I think we get the impression that it's, you know, pain-free, but actually it's not all roses and kilo shedding, is it? There are negative side effects to these drugs. The list is long. One of the most common that I've heard of is nausea and vomiting.
Yeah.
And some have referred to the Ozempic dose dispenser as a, quote, eating disorder pen. Is there worry about this for users who may have already struggled with disordered eating because of their weight?
Yes, I think definitely. And I think that you can sort of see that in some people who take them, because some people that I've talked to seem to become sort of obsessive about their weight as well, about their weight loss. And these are people who the drugs were intended for. These are people who are, you know, living with obesity mm-hmm. or are very overweight, but they weigh themselves like many times during the day. And I think that a friend of mine who did, you know, have an eating disorder when she was younger said, I'm so glad these drugs weren't around when I was sick. So I think that there is an element of that. But I think you're right about the side effects. There is nausea is one, diarrhea. There's a lot of gastric stuff. There's also some quite significant medical things. They're rare, but pancreatitis is one for where your pancreas becomes inflamed. So I think the message that I think that I really received from writing this book was, these are a really powerful pharmaceutical. They are a powerful pharmaceutical in the way that antibiotics are or HRT is, that these are like these things you wouldn't buy on the internet and you certainly wouldn't take them without supervision. And I think that that would ultimately be what people really need to do is if you need to be on these drugs, just go to your doctor. Mm. I don't think, you know, that's the biggest thing is that a lot of people are getting them online.
And the ripple effect of these drugs, you mentioned going out to dinner, it's having an impact on, for instance, in the hospitality sector, the way we eat. We're hearing examples of restaurants offering smaller servings. Some have got an Ozempic menu or the mini menu. In 2024, a survey showed 63% of the users of these drugs spend less money eating out. Are restaurants adjusting? Are they suffering? And what does this say about the extent of the use of these drugs?
I think the food industry more generally is a very big one about the sort of ripple of where these go, because a lot of companies, think Nestle, think Kraft, these kinds of companies who've been making pretty unhealthy food for a long time and have had, you know, a lot of people very interested in buying their food, is that they are that when it seems like when you're on these drugs, a lot of people I spoke to crave healthier food. So they're craving fresh produce like salmon and chicken and vegetables. And they don't really want those sort of ready meals and takeouts. Like one woman I spoke to said she was trying to buy a house with her partner, that they were really monitoring very carefully what they were spending so she could see how much she was spending on takeout. And then she goes on the drugs, that bill goes down to zero. And then they decided they wanted to have a baby. So she came off the drugs and the bill went right back up to where it was. So that's the other element of these drugs. It does seem like the research that we're seeing is that you have to stay on them as well.
Yeah, I've heard that. But that effect of not wanting junk food, I mean, that's another positive effect, as is the shedding the kilos in terms of the obesity epidemic, which we've talked about for some years now. Do you think these drugs will continue being a positive addition for managing people's health, or have we lost control of it? After studying it for a long time now and then researching this book, what's your view?
So I think that for the people they're intended for, I do think they are life-changing in some cases for them. So they, as you said, they really kind of manage like health issues. There's a lot of people who talk about food noise, which is this notion of like sort of internal chatter about food. Again, there was a woman I spoke to for the book who really talked about even at nighttime, she would be constantly thinking about food. And that this really went away on the drugs. And Oprah Winfrey has talked about this too, that this food noise just like quietens down. And that's one of the best effects of them. I think that to your point about, you know, them kind of running away, I think that there is a concern about that. I think more needs to be done to make it really, really difficult for people to buy these drugs that, as I said, that they are not intended for. And I think that if that's possible, if governments, if regulators are able to do that, then they could be, you know, a real benefit to society. If they are unleashed, if they continue to be unleashed in the way that they are, I think we will see a lot more damage to body positivity. I think there will be a much bigger focus on being thin. And I think that that has repercussions. I mean, for if you have children, if you have young girls, that has repercussions for them too, about the society that they're growing up in, because it was only a brief period where we weren't talking about that all the time. And it was quite a nice period, I would argue. And to get back to that, I think that wouldn't be good for anybody.
Amy, thank you so much for joining me.
Not at all. Lovely to talk to you. Thanks so much.
That's Reuters reporter Amy Donlan, and her new book, Off the Scales, The Inside Story of Ozempic and the Race to Cure Obesity, is published by HarperCollins. That's it from me for today. Thanks for your company. If you heard something you like, why not share it with your pals? Come and find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And I hope you can join me tomorrow too when I'm speaking with Amy Romikas. She's the Chief Political Analyst at the Australia Institute, about her new book, Where It All Went Wrong, The Case Against John Howard. It's a look back at yesteryear when the Liberal Party reigned supreme. Seems particularly pertinent given the polls and recent machinations within the Liberal Party. See you then. Good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.